publisher, as do certain reviewers, the dean of a leading business school in the Southwest wrote, well, if you follow the doctrines of this guy, he would say you should just maximize your profits, you'll publish the book, but if you have any sense of social responsibility, you won't, because it subverts the foundations of the republic. This was supposed to be an anonymous review. Unfortunately for the dean who did the review, another one of the reviewers took issue with him and gave his name. So this dean still pretends, and I still pretend to. He pretends that he never said that, and I pretend that I don't know that he said it. But anyway, I don't want to talk for more than half an hour. I'm going to try to watch my watch, because the meaning, the limitations, the significance of what I shall say will emerge, I think, in the process of dialogue among us. As you take issue or agree or raise questions or make qualifications and thoughts. I maintain that the very, very popular notion today that businessmen in America or businesses or corporations ought to be more socially responsible is an extraordinarily dangerous doctrine. I don't think there is any truth in it. I think every time you hear this, you should plug up your ears or say something like, phooey. And for three reasons. In the first place, the first reason is economic, the second is political, and the third is ethical. Let me begin with the economic. What a businessman ought to do when he comes to a situation where he has to decide is decide on the basis of largest anticipated profit. Because what is most profitable? Prospectively, of course. You know, you make mistakes. You often don't know. You often do the wrong thing. But what is the most profitable thing for the businessman to do is also the thing that he ought to do. Why? Because when a business makes a profit, it is allocating resources to their most highly valued use. That's the way you make profits. By taking resources out of less highly valued uses and shoving them into more highly valued uses. Valued by whom? Valued by the community, expressing its preferences through the marketplace. A business does not make profits by giving the public something it doesn't want. Adam Smith long ago said that he never knew much good to have been done by people who affected to trade for the public good. That the man who did the public most good was the guy who traded for his own interest, who was trying to make a buck. The thing is that if you have a market system, a competitive regime, reasonably competitive, the only way to make a buck is to provide something that the public wants. When a businessman says, well, I'm not going to maximize my profits here, I'm going to do something that is socially responsible, what he's really doing is sticking his judgment about what is good for the public on top of the public's judgment of what is good for the public. I mean, if the public says, for example, and I'll take a horrendous illustration here now, if the public says, we want cars with 732 horsepower and no brakes, and the businessman says, no, that's not good for them, I'll give them little bitty cars with enormous brakes, he's saying, I know better than the slobs what's good for them, and I will give them what I think they want. Now, I use that example deliberately because almost everyone would say, that's what he ought to do, by golly. But there's a kicker, of course. You know, if the public really wanted, as the Ford Motor Company found out some years ago, people really wanted automobiles built for speed, and he stressed safety, he would not sell his automobiles. You know, if you produce a product that is good for the public, but the public doesn't like it, you will be producing a product for inventory. And your competitors who are producing the product that the public wants will be filling up the market. Well, now, let me move on. But this suggests that the market always works perfectly, you know. It doesn't. There may be situations, there are many situations, some trivial, some perhaps very significant, where the market does not adequately guide businessmen's activities, so that the pursuit of profit by a business decision maker doesn't promote the public interest too effectively. The two kinds of situation in which this is likely to be true are, one, monopoly, and two, a situation where there are substantial neighborhood effects. I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment. But monopoly means that there just isn't enough competition. We can come back to this if you want to. I'm defining monopoly now very, very roughly. I'll define it as the absence of competition, and competition means that there are sufficient alternative suppliers so that the public isn't over the barrel. You know, how far over the barrel? It's always a matter of degree. You know, every seller has some monopoly power. The little mom and pop Schultz running a delicatessen on the corner of Elm and Spruce, they are monopolists, and since they have some monopoly power, they've got the consumer over. If you live right next door and right now you need salt, and you haven't got time to go all the way over to the Safeway, you're at the mercy of mom and pop Schultz, and they got you over the barrel. But that's a matter of degree. Nobody has absolute monopoly power. Even if you were the only drug manufacturer producing penicillin, you still wouldn't have absolute monopoly power because there are other antibiotics. And you know, there's such thing as going to bed with aspirin and hot water and hoping, too. but where there is substantial monopoly, that is to say, not too many good alternatives, then when the businessman maximizes his profits, he may not be diverting resources to their best use. It may be necessary for something to be imposed upon this situation. But what needs to be imposed upon this situation is a political decision. Now, without getting into any kind of technicalities, it turns out economists prove all sorts of things very logically and that nobody else ever understands, but all economists believe. I hope I can just persuade you to believe that if a guy has a monopoly and he maximizes his profits, he will be doing a better job of allocating resources than if he is a monopolist and doesn't maximize his profits. Now, the best situation would be that he didn't have that monopoly. But if you've got these three choices, no monopoly, monopoly not maximizing profits, and monopoly maximizing profits, the best situation is no monopoly, but the second best is a monopolist maximizing his profits. The existence of monopoly, in short, and again, you have to take this on faith, sorry, if you want to quarrel with it later, you can, but the existence of monopoly misallocates resources already. The failure to maximize profits given a monopoly situation further misallocates resources. I mean, steers resources away from those uses upon which the community places the highest value. So what I would like to see in these situations is political intervention. If the economy, if the marketplace is not working so as to promote the public welfare, it is the task of the public to look the situation over and decide what it wants changed and how it wants to change it. Like, invoke the antitrust laws. That may be what we need to do. But we are, for some reason, very reluctant to do that, and instead we wring out the doctrine of social responsibility and tell businessmen to set the whole thing in order, which they don't know how to do. And by the way, never trust the monopolist anyway. Well, how do you think that guy got to be a monopolist? He loves being a monopolist. If somebody has the power of life and death over me, I don't want to say to him, look, use that power responsibly. I would rather set up some checks and balances so that he no longer has that power. But we're, you know, that's a hard thing to do. That means taking political action, and we don't like to do that. We would rather preach. But there's a second, and I think much more important, type of situation in which we, the consumers, the general public of the United States, ought not to be content to just sit back and let businessmen maximize profits. That is the situation where there are substantial neighborhood effects. Now, a neighborhood effect means that the full costs or benefits of the activity in which a businessman is engaging are not being borne or received directly by that business. Example, when you produce steel and you throw smoke into the air, the steel producer does not pay the cost of the smoke. Now, that is a cost. It's a cost in terms of additional times the curtains have to be laundered, the house painted, you know, for all the people around. It's a cost, it's an aesthetic cost. You know, you can't see the sun. It's a tubercular cost, you know, all kinds of, well, smoke is a nuisance, and a nuisance inflicts a cost. Now, the steel producer isn't paying that cost. He's dumping that cost on other people. That's a neighborhood effect. Now, it can go the other way around. If you have a large plant, nice and clean, it has a lot of grounds, and it landscapes them beautifully so that its grounds look like a golf course. That confers substantial benefits on the people who live around there and drive by, benefits which the firm doesn't capture. Now, what happens? If you can dump a portion of the cost of your activity upon other people, you over-engage in that activity. Similarly, or conversely, if you are not able to capture the full benefits of your activity, you under-engage in that activity. I would say, for example, that most people do not take sufficiently good care of their lawns. Why do I say that? Because if you unless you live out in the wilderness somewhere, when you fix up your lawn pretty, you get some benefit yourself, but you also confer benefit upon all the other people in your neighborhood. But you don't take that into account fully, usually. Maybe you really love your neighbors and you do, but it's not likely that you take it fully into account. So that in an ideal world, people would bribe one another. You know, I would go to my neighbor and say, I'll give you 50 cents a month if you'll mow your grass a little oftener. I think this situation is a very, very serious problem now. The whole problem of control of the environment. And I argue ferociously that what we need to do with some of our environment pollutants or with some of our environment polluters is place taxes upon them so as to bring the private cost of their activity into line with the social cost of their activity. And the place where I want to begin is with the people who drive automobiles. Maybe next to the attorney of the people who smoke. Okay. But again, now the point is, when if industry is polluting the rivers, it is folly to say, come on, fellas, be socially responsible. Stop polluting the river. How much pollution may you, in a responsible way, dump into the river? You know, it is a matter of more or less. If you spit in the Mississippi, you're polluting it. Do you therefore not spit? For a business firm that's sitting along a river, not to pollute the river usually inflicts a cost upon the business. And the business says, well, gee whiz, that's a big cost. That'll really hurt us. Can we afford that? Suppose that the pollution is minor. And you know the pollution is almost always minor. What difference would it make if I, the Acme Manufacturing Company, stopped polluting the river? It would still be polluted because nobody else would stop. So I figure, well, what the heck? If I stop polluting, I'm going to have to incur tremendous costs that will practically drive me bankrupt. And it won't make any difference to the Mississippi River downstream anyway. So I just pollute away. It's a perfectly rational decision. There has to be political action if you're going to control this problem. You have to step in and impose costs on all the polluters so that they say, well, it just ain't worth my while to pollute. But as long as we go on hoping that pollution will disappear when businessmen have a change of heart, we're never going to get rid of pollution. It's not that businessmen are evil people. It's that businessmen, like everybody else, respond to the costs and incentives and benefits that they see before them. And their responses are perfectly rational responses, the same kind of responses that we employ when we're faced with situations. What we need to do is change the situation, and that's a matter for political action. It's not a matter for moral theologians. So then the third thing. Some people think that they would maybe agree to everything I'd said, but then they would add, but you're pretending that businessmen are just... It's all right for a businessman to be a crude profit maximizer. You know, somebody who would foreclose the mortgage on his grandmother if she were 3 days late. I'm not saying this at all. I'm not urging businessmen to adopt profit maximization as a philosophy of life. You know, so that when your secretary stumbles, you don't grab her arm unless you have carefully calculated the potential costs and benefits to the firm of doing so. What I'm saying is when a businessman is faced with a decision situation, you know what that is. There's most things you just go ahead and do. I didn't make a calculation this morning of whether I was going to maximize my profits by getting up for breakfast or not getting up for breakfast. I just sort of stumbled up for breakfast from the sheer weight of blind instinct. But I am talking about decision situations, which is what we're usually worried about when we talk about social responsibility. We think that businessmen are faced with crucial decisions which will affect the weal or woe of the whole society. And we think they're deciding wrongly. and we want them to stop paying so much attention to profitability and start paying more attention to their social responsibility. Well, I'm arguing now that in those situations, it is socially responsible for a businessman to pay attention to profitability. And I cannot give him any better criterion to which he should pay attention. The businessman who claims to have some criterion for business decision-making that is higher than profitability, I strongly suspect. That he's an arrogant, presumptuous man, that he is deluding himself. I really suspect that he wants to be a kind of a philosopher king instead of a businessman. I further suspect that he's not very satisfied with the meaning and value of the work in which he's engaged. I think that the tendency for businessmen to get together with their conventions and trade associations these days and lecture one another on their duty to be socially responsible is that this is a kind of a symptom of status anxiety. I think that businessmen have been losing some confidence in the value and meaning of their principal activity. And they're trying to sort of buck up their confidence by telling one another that they are really responsible for the welfare of the Republic. And come on, fellows, let's be philosopher kings. Benevolent despots. I don't like benevolent despots. I mean, I don't think that even a benevolent despotism is ever just. And most despots don't remain benevolent for too long. As I don't think also the businessmen have anything like the amount of power that they or the general public seem to think they have. Of course, businessmen don't always think they have this power. A businessman is usually supremely conscious of the sharp limitations which the market imposes upon him. He's usually aware of how little room for maneuver he really has. You know, and if I go just a little bit further in this direction, I've had it. You know, when we urge businessmen to use some of the enormous resources of business to, we tote up aggregate profits, and we say, last year the corporate sector had gross profits of so many billions of dollars. You know, why doesn't business use this? Well, those billions of dollars weren't in anybody's hands. They weren't at anybody's disposal. There is nobody called the business sector who can allocate these things. There are just individual business decision makers who are operating under budget constraints, who are being audited, who have shareholders screaming at them, who have an uncertain future to prepare for, and well, they don't have the power that the public thinks they have. At least that's my view. We can argue that. But what about the claim that well, I've been told that I'm really urging businessmen to be unethical? I get extremely upset about this because, especially when it comes from Lutherans, because to pretend that if you established a code of responsible business practice, and if you got the businessmen in the chemical industry together to draft a code of fair dealings, which they all adhered to, that then they would be ethical men, is to confuse law and gospel. Now, I don't usually run around telling the Dallas Management Club that they're confusing law and gospel. I tell them something like, a good fruit doesn't produce a good tree. Or being ethical is a matter of being, not doing. You don't become ethical by following a bunch of, following the realtor's code of fair practice. And they usually recognize this. You know, I say to the car dealers, I say, you guys got a code of fair practice for car dealers, don't you? Right. Where do you post it? You know where the post is? They post it out in the front where the customers can see what good guys they are. If they're really serious about it, they would post it in the back room where they can study it, meditate upon it, read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest. But this is the function of codes of fair practice, to get the public off his guard, knowing all the realtors, we are dedicated to providing every American a quality home at a fair price. They're interested. At a picture. I want businessmen to be ethical. Alfred North, I couldn't quote Alfred North Whitehead because I was too. Alfred North Whitehead says that the mind of a community tends to be dominated by the business mentality. And therefore, it is essential that businessmen think greatly of their function. A society in which businessmen adopt debased thoughts and debased modes of thinking is a society which will, after a brief orgy of exploitation, sink into a debased condition, something like that. If the men of business were kind of the architects of order and rationality in practical life, do not think greatly of their functions, do not have vision and foresight, and something called wisdom, you know, the ability to appreciate a wide range of values, then Whitehead thinks we're going to drift toward stagnation and nastiness and pettiness, and we'll be fighting about everything. And I thoroughly agree with it. But businessmen do not learn to think greatly of their functions by adopting a code of fair practice. How does a man learn to think greatly of his functions? I think he does so by learning to think greatly of himself. And I believe that the businessman who wants to become ethical should forget about ethics for a while and should think about being human. This is what our businessmen need today. I think that the business community needs more opportunities to learn what it means to become more fully human and how to become more fully human, and not just businessmen. College professors, too, and butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers. But I would say it's particularly important for the businessmen because of the enormous influence that they have on the mentality and outlook of an era, of our era. Now, what I would like to see businessmen learn to do, like everybody else, is to accept the world as a gift, to learn to receive it with thanksgiving, to learn to view their jobs not as something by means of which they justify themselves, but as an opportunity, a challenge, something in which to be creative. And if they fail, to be able to accept this without being personally destroyed. These are the kinds of directions in which I would like to see businessmen thinking if they're really concerned about being ethical. Well, I did it. I took only 22 minutes to lay out the outline of my case, but there are all sorts of little skeletons tucked away in closets which some of you may have detected or thought about. So I will stop and say, what do you think about all that? Yes, sir. Okay.
I can agree with what you said, but tucked away is one of those causes to say political action is necessary. Given the interlocking nature of our present political alignment, two-party system, with the economy, are you suggesting a new kind of politics that will walk outside the present political alignment? In other words, is there any hope of any kind of political action from our present political alignment?
Well, we get political action all the time, don't we? I mean, the state of Washington is always passing laws, and Congress is always passing laws, most of them fairly stupid, but we're getting political action. But obviously, you mean we're not getting the political action we need. Now, what political action do we need right now that we're not getting? Can you be specific, and then I'll...
I suppose the thing that interests me most, I'm in Southern California, I'm a very fast. There are many people in my congregation who are now looking for work because they're aeronautical engineers. The only hope they have of getting work is drifting on somewhere where there is a company that's hooked up with full consent on full work, because there is not that much work being done in aeronautical engineering outside of defense contracts. And it seems to me that here's a whole industry, and these people that come to Seattle know probably more about this than those of us in San Diego, all the both cities that we've been affected by this sort of thing. Here's an industry that seems so plugged in to the war machine, or the defense machine, whatever you want to call it, that people who really enjoy being aeronautical engineers, these guys have come to their education that they enjoy design work. Many of them told me with tears in their eyes, you know, I don't know what else I'm going to do because I actually enjoy designing aircraft, you know. But their wives are hooked up with an activity that it seems to be an influence. It's affecting their lives. It's affecting a whole industry. And yet we need to be just plugged into it and marching down the route that we've got to continue to have
okay, well now, you've described the situation very broadly and nicely. Now, what would you do if you were king? You don't know. All right, see, now that's, I don't know either. And I think it's significant to notice that. We have a habit of blaming our political system for failing to arrive at decisions when we don't even know what decisions we wanted to arrive at. See, it isn't then a problem of the political system not cranking out decisions in accord with the public will, it's that the public doesn't know what its will is. And I think it's a serious mistake to blame the political system for failures of intellect. Huh? Of imagination.
Right, and every sector has to think through what it wants, what its goals are. And certainly the political sector as well as the business sector has to think about it.
Well, yeah. I think the general public has to be thinking about this. It needs help. I think we need more imaginative social architects, not social engineers, but architects, people who will sketch plans, alternative plans, on which the public can meditate, in which it can discuss. What do we do? We don't want an industry devoted to destruction. We certainly don't want it if the very existence of that industry tends to promote destruction in order to keep up the demand for the industry. I don't know whether that's so, but many people think it's so. But what are we going to do with all of the people who are trained to work in this industry? How are we going to make it possible for them to shift into more constructive types of activity? Well, this is a task not just for congressmen, it's a task for social architects. And ultimately, it's a task then for the public, because I don't like the plans of social architects to be put into effect without public discussion and that kind of at least partial consensus that is reflected in congressional approval. But so often, you know, we hear it in the ecology problem, we hear it all the time. It's as if there are a group of evil-minded men in Washington somewhere who are being bought off by the big lobbies so that they don't do what has to be done to correct the pollution problem. Well, you go, you're sitting with a group of people who are all upset about pollution and ask them, what needs to be done? What shall we do? And the answer you get is, write your congressman. Yeah, write your congressman and tell him what. And when the person can't answer that, then he's reflecting the situation that we don't know what needs to be done. Am I missing your, or are we engaging in dialogue?
No, I'm following you. Yet given the realities of the way our society is ordered, it seems to me that the political sector is probably the one from which people look for leadership in this area. Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure. I'm afraid of getting trapped by answering. I'm not sure what you mean by. If you mean that when we have a problem, people expect the government to do something.
Somehow, either the local municipal government or the county board of supervisors or the state legislature or Washington.
Yeah. Okay.
Is going to give us a leadership. Yeah. Isn't this one of the expectations that people have?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't see how
a That's one of the expectations they have. But see, that's continually disappointed. It's frustrated. So then they turn, now they're turning and say, well, our businessmen, you do it. Sometimes they turn to the churches, too, you know, and they say, why don't the churches? You know, how come the churches have been around now for 2,000 years and still people don't love one another?
And, you know. Public can really adequately police business, you know, really control it. I have two examples. One is I can imagine that some chemist in some factory along Lake Michigan knew that the mercury was going out into the lake 20 years ago and knew that we were killing fish and so on, you know, but it took a long period of time before this became a problem that was picked up by the public.
Mm-hmm.
Paper plants down in Oregon, you know, on the Willamette River, they make a pulp, and every once in a while, the content of the sulfide in the water becomes too high, begins to kill things, and the public becomes upset about this, or the officials represent the public. And so this company takes the waste product and puts it in the holding pond for a while until the public kind of simmers down, and then they can use it later on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's
time elements,
so
you
can't check constantly.
So
I'm wondering if business sector doesn't have to have this kind of a conscience. You should encourage it as much as possible.
Yeah. Well, I'd say no. Because what we do not need is a system of spot checks on industrial pollution. We need a system where everyone is allowed to pollute if he pays the costs of doing so. Now, it will be difficult in some instances, but not as difficult as people imagine, to establish a system of pollution monitoring. I mean, everybody should be free to pollute. We all pollute, you know, but we should bear the costs of our pollution. And what we do today is we say, nobody should pollute. Pogo sort of makes an interesting joke out of this. He's, you know, this movement that's been running through the comic strip for some time, let's all stop breathing. That's sometimes the idea we get. Let's all stop breathing, all stop having children, stop burning anything. Well, clearly, that's not what we want. And when we realize that isn't what we want, then we shift to the other extreme and we'll say, well, everybody pollute if you want to, but be socially responsible. Now, the problem is no one knows how much pollution is socially responsible. I'll repeat something I said last week on Earth Day. Pollution is not sin. Pollution is a cost generated by an activity that also confers benefits or else people wouldn't do it. So how much pollution is socially responsible? Some is. As long as the benefits are in excess of the costs, pollution is a good thing. But the businessman is just in no position. He doesn't have the information that would enable him to decide how much pollution is okay. Can he put any waste in the water? What about biodegradable versus non-biodegradable wastes? I'm just unwilling to leave this to the businessman's decision because, one, he doesn't have the information to really evaluate his own pollution activity, and two, if he does try to decide, he is a biased judge. You know, that even with the best will in the world, we're all biased. You know, if you ask me, my wife and I have a dispute, you say, come on now, sit back and ask yourself impartially, who's right? I'll say, okay, I'll do that. By golly, I'm right. It's amazing. I always discover that. And, you know, and it is, I don't think it's just sin that's responsible for that original sin. I think I know my situation intimately. I mean, I know why I do the things I do. I know the ins and the outs of my particular situation. I don't know the ins and outs of somebody else's. Have you ever reflected on how rarely you find a person who admits that what he did was wrong? We always can explain it. And if you're urging businessmen to be socially responsible, I think you're telling Leo DeRocher to umpire all Chicago Cubs games. And now Leo's a good man and true, I'm sure, but I think he's a little warped.
I think you're casting your enemies, or those that disagree with you, in a light where they feel that businessmen are not morally responsible at all.
I think this is a fallacy. And I hear you saying today yourself that casting the businessman in the image that he is not morally responsible, and that's okay. I see them in the light that they are morally responsible in a relative fashion. And maybe the answer is the businessman is morally responsible, and he can be morally responsible to the degree that he is convinced that he has been contributed to the company. You can sell him with a certain moral responsibility if you help him on the production. Again, this works. That's why they have safety measures in the mine here. That's why the National Alliance for Businessmen believes that hiring black people is a profitable venture, because if the working force of black people will continue to grow.
Yeah, but okay, I have no objection to what you're saying. I don't think it's necessary to spend much time telling businessmen to do the morally correct thing because it's profitable. A businessman will do the morally correct thing when it's profitable without much urging. They're always looking around. Well, yeah, but you can't give that to them. Can you? If you can show a businessman that it's good business to hire the handicapped, if you can really show him this, and he didn't realize it before, sure, then once you show him that, you won't have to say, now that is the expository part of my sermon, let me now give you the peroration, go thou and hire the handicapped. As soon as you showed him it's profitable, he'll want to do it, huh? Okay, so if businessmen don't have good information, give them better information. But it's not likely that you or I will have better information than the businessman has about his situation. It's possible, but I don't think it's likely in too many instances.
But then you're saying that the business sort of determines what society wants.
No, I'm not saying that. The businessmen respond to what they think society wants, and society is continually registering its preferences through the marketplace.
Paul, I think this illustrates something that happened in our San Juan Islands, where Kaiser Lumber wanted to go in. It was profitable, it was a good location, it had a wide open area, and it was good for the people of that particular section because it would reduce their taxes, in fact, almost eliminate them. But then a wider region of people got interested. This is our recreation area. And they got involved in this thing. And obviously, the people on the island were not happy about this because they saw this thing fading away. But finally prevailed upon the group, and the common consensus was this will be more meaningful, and I think the profit end was in on it too, if we keep it at the recreation area rather than to make it a Kaiser Luna plant. Is this what I hear you say?
Well, if the public spoke, I don't know through what mechanism the public spoke.
Well,
but
through the existing structure is the way that it can happen.
Well, did some political body refuse to allow Kaiser to move into the San Juans? What?
He got another technicality.
It was done through an injunction primarily. The people that lived close to it got a injunction stop them from building it, and their whole intent was simply to delay them long enough that they changed their minds and go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't think they actually ever win the suit, but they were able to delay them, and the company finally decided to work in it. Mm-hmm. It was more profitable to go elsewhere than to wait.
So they used
years to go through the court system to build it there.
So some people used the political process in effect to inflict higher costs upon Kaiser, the costs of delay, and dissuaded them. And it's not a good example of what I have in mind, because you have so many partial interests here moving. You know, you've got people who will live right near the plant who don't want it, people who will live farther away who see the tax advantages, and probably some people on the islands too who say, I don't care, I'm willing to pay taxes, I like the privacy and the seclusion and the non-industrial nature of the islands. Plus all the people in Washington who like to go vacationing in the San Juans, and It's a very tricky question to decide what the public interest requires in a situation like this. And I think we've got a lot of problems like that in our society, deciding what the public interest requires. You know, it just ain't easy. A lot of people who get up and talk as if they know, as if they had a direct vision from Mount Sinai, which says that you should not have a park up here. That's a very interesting example. You know, you got the gung-ho nature lovers who didn't want a park because the slobs will come in. And then you've got the people who didn't want a park because they want to turn the whole thing into, preferably level the mountains and grow wheat or something. And then in between, the people who want a park so that more people can enjoy the wilderness. And among all of these conflicting tugs and pulls, complicated always by little communities sitting in there who are looking for tax advantages and new tourist business and all that, it's very hard to decide what the public interest requires. But I think that the broader and fuller the public discussion of the issue is, the more complete the information is, which is available to the public, about the consequences of alternative choices, the more likely we are, through the political process, to reach a decision that's consistent with the public interest. You had your hand up.
I wasn't a while ago, but I saw the state of Green now, even reference to this young comment about the aircraft workers and the fact that we have had this problem in the United States, and shouldn't the government do something about it? And the question that came to my mind is all the creative individual businessmen who were in business for themselves and being successful, who were also affected by this. Nobody helps them.
Yeah.
They go down.
That's true.
And they push themselves up.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know who was... You know. Okay.
Is it... your argument hinges on the possibility that the public can set costs in terms of your neighborhood, that the neighborhood, the public can assess cost to an industry that is polluting. And, you know, I'm not quite ready to accept that assumption, that possibility. I see that there's a whole thing that you spell it out hinges on that one assumption, and that is a possibility. If that isn't a possibility, then we have to look elsewhere for a way in which to handle the problem. If we can accept that assumption, then everything you said makes sense.
Okay, then let me try to make you accept that assumption very briefly. If the public can't assess costs, is there anyone who can? The cost of pollution.
Well, I'm not sure the public can.
All right, I agree. Let's assume the public cannot. I'm now asking you, in your view, is there anyone who can? Then the problem is insoluble.
Then we have to look elsewhere in terms of resolving the problem.
Well, the problem is insoluble. If no one can assess the cost, I think the problem is insoluble.
And we go back to the assumption that you're trying to refute, namely that the business acts best.
Yeah, but the businessman can't assess the costs either. Right, so the businessman can't assess it. So what does it mean to tell the businessman to be socially responsible? He does not know the costs of what he's doing.
No, but he can have something different than what he's doing.
No, it seems to me you are smuggling in one of two assumptions in your vacillating business. Either the businessman knows that what he is doing inflicts a cost burden upon the public and he has some rough notion of the extent of this cost burden, or he does not. Now, if he does, then someone can assess the cost. The businessman can assess the cost.
Okay, well,
if he does not...
He does, like
okay.
In the river.
Okay.
And it takes 20 years for us to find out. Now, if I live in a community where I make my living off of that particular business, which is another, sort of problem. We went through a lot of towns in Oregon and Washington, where they're polluting the air with lumber mills. And see that community assessing a pollution cost on the industry that they make their living.
Okay, if the community doesn't want to do it, why should it be done? If you don't look, you see, we do have to face unpleasant choices in this world. If the community is willing to live under a haze of hickory smoke, or whatever, because that provides jobs, and they don't want to move out of this town, it seems to me that's their business.
So they aren't looking responsibly into the future. I mean, if they live in L.A. and work for smog, and you think, say, okay, we can
to whom?
I mean, it's going to get worse and worse
for
our children.
You're not being responsible to your children. Well, I wish you hadn't jumped in the hickory smoke to the wood smoke to the smog. Because I don't think there. You've shifted from a pollution problem created by industry to a pollution problem created by several million Los Angelinos who drive automobiles. And what the Los Angeles, I don't think the people in Los Angeles are being irresponsible. I think they're being stupid. Now, there's a difference. To be stupid means not to recognize, not to be aware of the consequences of your action and the devices that can be used to bring about better consequences. And I don't think that the people in Los Angeles, I don't think most of the people in the United States are aware of the fact that there is a mechanism that can control automobile pollution, and that is a higher tax on gasoline. And when they do think about it, somebody proposes it, they see only one consequence of this, and that is that they won't be able to drive their cars as much. And they don't see the other consequence, that nobody will be able to drive their car as much. Well, okay. I'm blurring them together. I think that one of the big differences is that, and it's okay to fudge them together, one of the big differences is that we're all willing to tell industry to stop polluting and to fine it, clobber it, and so on if it won't stop polluting, because we don't think that we are going to have to bear any of the costs of that. But we're not as willing to make ourselves stop polluting, because we do become aware very quickly of the costs that we have to bear.
I was just thinking of the fact
that there are a lot of people in that area involved in
the
city.
I mean,
yeah.
They're in that business, but they
would suffer. Yeah. Just like now, they would suffer. Well, that's a little different thing, though, than what you just said and what, how we started. Although I realize that maybe that's what you're kind of speaking up to.
Well, look, on the whole question of pollution, again, pollution, I think it's always important to remember this, is not a bad, and it's not an unalloyed bad thing. Pollution is good, insofar as activities that confer benefits are good. People don't pollute for the sake of polluting. Industry pollutes in order to create a product that makes people happier and better off.
Yeah, but how can you accept that assumption today, that the consequences of pollution may be, it's all right if you can assess the cost, and by assessing the cost,
the consequences of some pollution, the consequences of some pollution are such that the costs are now outweighing the benefits. And we have to become aware. This is a matter for analysis, for the intellect. We have to become aware of precisely where this is the case, and then we have to invoke, I think, a political mechanism to control and correct the situation. I'm just not willing to allow every polluter to look into his heart and into his Bible and decide where pollution ceases to be a socially beneficial activity and becomes a socially disastrous activity. I believe that there have to be broader controls.
They think that they are feasible, and they can be established. Yeah.
They have been established. I mean, there have been, just take smoke. Smoke has been controlled in areas where the cities really got serious about it. And it's just obvious that the automobile can be controlled. if the people are willing to impose upon themselves collectively the full burdens of driving an automobile. If every Los Angeles citizen, when he gets into his automobile, were compelled to pay the full cost of his driving the automobile, which would include the smog contribution and the congestion contribution, he would drive his automobile a lot less. Moreover, as people stop driving their automobiles so much, it would become profitable for somebody, private industry even, to build a rapid transit system. For as long as you have a situation in our major cities where people are in effect subsidized to drive automobiles by being allowed to drive them at less than the full cost, you're going to get increasingly crummy public transportation systems, and hence a continually higher incentive to drive your automobile. And we've got to reverse this structure of incentives.
Well, in one case is the stockholder that pays, and the other case is the individual who has to pay. Is this what you're saying?
No, I think that when the problem is industry and we impose controls or taxes upon industry, the consumer winds up paying too. I mean, if the steel industry in Gary, Indiana, is forced to pay the full costs of its pollution so that the citizens of Gary don't have to pay it, let's just say. I, as a steel consumer, am going to wind up paying a portion of that cost. It's a question of the incidence of the tax.
But also the stockholder, because the stockholder will get less return and the consumer also has to pay more.
In the short run, the stockholder will get less of a return, but over a longer haul, I suspect it won't make much difference. It's hard to say. It's going to depend upon elasticities of demand and supply and elasticities of substitution, you know, to what extent there are other products that can be substituted and the actual cost of the pollution control and so on. But the consumer, I think this needs to be stressed, that when we're saying, we public saying, industry, stop thy polluting, or we'll make you, we are saying, impose upon us the costs, because we are going to pay the cost. I mean, finally, I think it's useful to think of industry as a group of complex of institutions and buildings that are being operated to produce the things that we demand. And if they can no longer operate as efficiently as they formerly could, we're going to get less or get the same amount at a higher cost. I mean, there's no other way around. I think she was next in Russ.
If this is directly connected to that example, you mentioned in your example the Gary steel mill. And that brings up the point that if only the local government in Gary imposed some penalty on steel mills, that would hit the stockholders of those particular plants, because they couldn't raise their steel prices, because the steel price is set by all the steel mills in the country. In order for this to be reasonably fair to the stockholders of the company, this should be a nationwide action, which requires all steel mills to be penalized in the same way.
Well, I don't think so.
They raise their prices, and they aren't merely imposing an extra cost on some businesses and not on others. Yeah. That's an argument I've heard.
Did you want to?
What if you control everything in the U.S. and we haul it all over there and we clean up the pan and we process the oil in the edge of Africa instead of on our shores, and we can get Cuba back? You know, we used to have Cuba at one time and set aside for our oil. You know, the senators of Panama was actually control the oil that all the refined in Cuba. And long range plans were to move all the refineries that are now taking from Cuba. Well, you do all that, or we're going to police the rest of the world, and we sit here on little clean island.
If I can generalize your point, we're going to have to decide not only how much of certain polluting activities we want by deciding what cost we're willing to pay for the fruits of those polluting activities, but we are also going to have to make decisions about where are the better places to pollute. Now, you take care. The reason that the city fathers of Gary don't slap a tax on the U.S. steel plant there is because that is not a terribly profitable plant, and they know it, and they don't want to close it down. So in effect, they're saying, in the interest of the whole community of Gary, it is better to live with this smoke. Now, I think that's a decision that they must be allowed to make. You know, after all, you don't have to live in Gary. thank God. But you say, but nobody should have to live in Gary. Well, okay, but nobody should be forbidden to live in Gary either. There are advantages to living in Gary, net advantages, or people wouldn't live there. One of the advantages is proximity to a steel mill that hires people at pretty good wages. Now, you can't have everything. If you want that steel mill hiring you at pretty good wages, you're going to have to live with the smoke. And one advantage of living with the smoke is that not too many people want to live with that smoke, so not too many people live in Gary, so it's kind of hard for U.S. Steel to get employees. So you can get a job there. In other words, there are certainly some steel plants. There are cleaner and dirtier steel plants, but there are also steel plants located in areas where pollution is better than it would be in other areas. So if it turns out that, say, slapping a tax, if a community slaps a tax on some factory that's really polluting in full knowledge of the consequences, and that plant has to close down, I do think we should be concerned about ex post facto legislation here, be a little bit concerned about compensation. Oh. But
why not do it nationwide, and then nobody gets thrown out of work anywhere?
Because I think that is using too broad an approach to the problem. There are certain kinds of activities that I don't think we want to see carried on in the middle of St. Louis Park that are all right to carry on in Whiting, Indiana. Wouldn't you agree? Well, I mean, you know,
I just say that
chickens pollute. I don't want to ban chickens.
I mean, let's get all the steel mills to clean up at the same time, and that way the price of steel will go up, but no one plant gets hurt to the point of having to close.
Yeah. Well, that's a kind of a good idea. The trouble is, you have to be careful of applying it to particular situations. They're just.
Why?
Because applying a uniform standard doesn't hit everybody uniformly. Suppose that we established the rule on the volleyball court that to make all things equal, nobody could jump. Now that would, you say that treats everybody the same. No, it doesn't. Dave Tinsley has a tremendous advantage. The person, because he's clumsy, but boy is he tall. that would give me an advantage because I'm pretty tall and I'm getting old and I can't jump too well. It would be a serious disadvantage to Daryl, who isn't too tall but can really jump. See, he's got good timing. Now, you see my point that when you apply a perfectly uniform standard, it does
life.
Hit different industries.
It's going to happen.
Well, that's life, but there's another way to do it, and that is to apply a standard that affects communities uniformly. Not a uniform standard, but some kind of standard that is uniform in its effects. Now, what would that standard be? There is some room, I think, for uniform. And Russ's point is an important one. There's a great danger that if isolated communities start imposing taxes, that they will just be shoving problems around. Something like the situation of the reason the states didn't introduce unemployment insurance because they were afraid they would lose industry to other states. So we needed to kind of uniform, nationwide unemployment system. There are situations like that, but there are many situations having to do with pollution. But what I think we need is standards established by the relevant community, where the community is free to decide that, well, because of the benefits that we reap from the existence of this industry that does indeed smoke up the air, we will tolerate this industry. So you've got a bunch of, say, money-hungry smoke lovers live here, and nature-loving people who don't care about money, only love is beautiful, they live over there. There are diversities of interests. You know, there are lots of people who aren't bothered by pollution, smoke, who think nothing is more beautiful than a billboard. And I want to respect this great diversity of tastes.
What about the opposite of giving them a tax break rather than imposing a tax?
Well,
and then this spreads the cost to all the other people who have to pick up the additional tax with that tax break.
There's something to be said for that in particular situations.
In a particular, that's what I mean, in a particular situation.
But the taxing doesn't make any sense in any level to me unless you're using that tax money to make a solution to the problem. You're just maintaining the
that would be the reason
operation
for it. Mm-hmm.
By taxing.
But if the operation is the problem, then eliminating the operation is eliminating the problem.
But you know, many of the operations are necessary. You'll either move in or, but unless you're using that second one for the purpose of, for instance, using this refuge for some usable thing, I mean, for research, let's say, putting it into something like gasoline in Los Angeles, I don't live that close to Los Angeles, but I know very well, if they doubled the tax, I'd still drive just as much, I'd just eat less.
Well, I want you to be free to do that.
Yeah.
But you know, everybody wouldn't, fortunately.
I bet you wouldn't.
No. No, they just wouldn't.
I don't think that's a problem. Why not take the money and use it for research to find a device that you're supposed to smoke?
With this, you don't need research. The invention has already been made. It's called trains.
Yeah.
TRANES, I think. The trains aren't running because people are being subsidized to drive their automobiles and fly the airplanes. So the trains don't run. If we stop subsidizing people to drive and fly, they will stop driving and flying so much, and then they'll look around for alternative methods of transportation, and behold, the passenger train will return, like the passenger pigeon. Now you can't. I have no objection. It's a good idea, maybe, for the state to take some of the tax revenue collected and provide subsidies to the passenger railroads, perhaps.
I don't want subsidies. I want solutions to problems.
But you're talking about subsidies. If you talk about taking some of this money and using it to support research, that's a subsidy. The researchers.
Well,
sure.
They wouldn't do it otherwise.
But I don't think that we need as much research, technical research, as we need social research here. We need to think about, much of the technology is available, but the technology is too costly. If we shift around costs and benefits through taxes and subsidies, the already existing research will be employed, put to work. Yes, sir.
I'm going to throw forth the example of the Volkswagen train. Why did it become so effective in America? Only because people wanted to stop paying so much price for gasoline and get along with less. But what it eventually did, though, was we're subsidizing some other country we probably shouldn't ever have been. But you had the freedom of choice.
She
still has the freedom of choice to run a dangerous car.
didn't you? Was it you?
What about the recent had just worked in a foundry where they had we installed about $1 million of air pollution. They have electric
equipment.
Really a modern foundry. Well, right across the street, a small foundry that was family owned, never really developed. And they had a cupola on there. Smoke just belching out of his place. What are you doing, kids, like this?
Pass a law.
Okay, you pass the law. Then you get back to the legislation again. You knock that little guy out of work. And let the big guy push on. The big guy has been more efficient. He's gone ahead. He's advanced. You knock the little guy out of his operation because he can't afford him to go into this thing. I go out to a certain point now. You should set the standards. I think this was maybe what you tried to say. Building codes are standards. You know, you can only be so close to the lake with distribution centers, so you don't pollute this thing. And the codes and the standards would be enforced, like you say, you can pollute to a certain extent. And like all these people are saying, the steel mill in Gary would have to be so many parts per minute you come out of their smoke stack as the one in Cleveland or up on the North Shore or something like that. Then it would be equal all the way around. And the pollution problem would still be going on, but it would be more equal. The engineers of these buildings and these companies, is when they sit down to make a floor finish or something, they design the checks and balances of the profits that they could get out of it, and they evaluate this thing. If they think they can make it, they'll go ahead and put it through, like you say. If they don't think they can put it on the market for a profit, boom, it's up. I had a course that Purdue, just a short course, Professor Lizak was there, and he said, look, take the ballpoint pen when it first came up. $10 you fixed that ballpoint pen. Now you pay 19 cents for it. And this is the economy today. Business has, and you can't legislate business, otherwise you start getting into the black market and so forth like this.
Well, there you got to be careful about legislation. I don't believe in calling the cop every time you got a problem, but there some legislation can and needs to be applied. And I
don't think that a certain standard, a uniform, like this gentleman over here said, a national standard could be set up, and of course then it's got to be policed properly.
Oh, no, I answered the question, no. I think there are very few areas where national standards are appropriate, because situations differ. And the danger of national standards is it forces different people who are in different situations into a common mold, and that's inequitable. And I mean, when one drives his automobile through Montana, he is not imposing the same social costs as when he drives it through Los Angeles. So I don't think that the same standards need apply in Montana and Los Angeles. If that was the coffee break bell, so you're free. The exam will be on. Don, I'm sorry.
Is that the only area where we're exploring?
No. I'm sorry. We just focused on that so exclusively. With that old business, I would say a lot of people said, you know, after Congress imposed uniform safety standards in automobile manufacture, it said it's a shame that Detroit didn't do this on its own. And I said, baloney. There's no reason to expect Detroit to do it. Detroit was producing cars that people wanted. And if we want to make a political judgment that says the judgment of the marketplace is inappropriate, well, I believe in the veto of democratic politics over democratic economics. But it's got to be a political decision, because the automobile manufacturer who would choose to give the public what it ought to have instead of what it wanted would be an automobile manufacturer who didn't sell automobiles. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Just for the record, I'm opposed to most of that safety legislation. I don't think it was a good idea, but then she asked, do we need more Nader's? I think no. I think Nader is he's an interesting guy. I think he throws up more smoke. I think Nader creates a pollution problem. Messiah in everybody.
What if we take Paul Ehrlich's panic button idea on pollution that we got just a very few years? The interest of the entire economy that really take a serious look at the pollution problem for the good of mankind.
Well, I think
it should become a moral or economic movement.
I think Paul Ehrlich is even worse than Nader. I mean, that guy, I really get upset with him. Where he shoots off his little camp of eco-catastrophe, for example. He's just talking irresponsibly. He makes extrapolations that are based on current conditions, but those extrapolations would make impossible the continuance of the existing conditions. I mean, he talks about how the population will grow if we don't do something, and he doesn't point out to us that if the population does begin growing in this direction, the situation will change so that it no longer can grow in that direction. You know, I mean, there's silly examples. If people are indeed standing on each other's heads, that's going to make the sex act a little difficult and will probably reduce the birth rate. But I think what Nader is telling us is, whoa, the world is coming to an end. What are you going to do? And he's telling us, push the panic button. He doesn't tell us anything concrete. He mumbles about some, I think, politically very dangerous things like slapping on laws, forbidding people to have more children. I hate that kind of approach. If what we could do is leaving people free is to say, we're going to stop subsidizing people for having children, because that's what we're not now doing. We're going to begin making people pay the full cost of the children they have. Well, he doesn't.
Instead of a $600 tax deduction, you impose a tax upon people.
Yeah, but he doesn't. He doesn't always say. You can read most of his popular stuff, and that doesn't emerge. You just come up with these extraordinary extrapolations from which one draws, what conclusion do you draw from this, other than we're in a mess? Sometimes, I think the conclusion that people draw from Ehrlich is, it's all over anyway, and I don't think that's useful.
Publicly, he doesn't say that.
He does, yeah. I got a little pamphlet over in my bedroom right now where it's his projection. I don't know if you've seen Eco Catastrophe. You see how the world is going.
Unless we do some very serious changes by 1972, then he says, I think we're on the irrevocable side.
Yeah.
Well,